Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 144 from May 26, 2008. The FBI versus the Internet. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/twit. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. It's time for This Week in Tech. We are going to talk about tech and nothing but tech. Except if some kids come in the room, and then we might talk about kids. And if John has to leave to do some pulled pork, we might talk about barbecue. And maybe a little Twitter. But other than that, I am Leo Laporte joining us right now. Denise Howell, we're so glad to have you. You took some time on your vacation, and I really appreciate it, Denise.
Sure, my pleasure.
Denise does, of course, This Week in Law, which is really a great podcast on the TWiT Network, all about the law of the Internet. And she's a very well-known as a blogger for many years at Bag and Baggage and FCAS, now at Logarithms, which is her a blog column for ZDNet, which is blogs.znet.com/Howell. And in fact, you talk about Twitter on this one, but we won't get into that. We don't got to. Every time I say the word, we get in trouble. Also here, the real Dvorak, John C. Dvorak.
You know, Leo, I can see why you don't want to talk about Twitter, because there was this contest.
Oh, yeah, that.
That ended today.
Yeah. Did I win?
Yes, of course you did. You know that. And so.
I actually want to apologize because I ended the show on a very negative note last week, and I feel so bad about it. And Kevin and I have kissed and made up, and I said a foolish thing. I was, as Valleywag said, drunk and out of control. In an attempt to win this stupid horse race on Hubdub, I said, if you follow me and you unfollow Kevin, if you follow me and Dvorak and you unfollow Kevin, we'll put you in this contest. And then I heard from a sweepstakes attorney that really wasn't a good idea.
Yeah, that was setting off some bells and whistles in my head as you were saying it.
Oops. So can I take it back?
Well, the whole thing, if it's actually humor, I think you have a lot more leeway.
It really was. I was just fooling around.
And also, the fact of the matter is, and I can reveal this now. Well, let me reveal it later.
Save it for the end of the show, right after the Audible commercial. Would you do that?
Yeah, let me put it down, a little note here.
But we are gonna build the ultimate gaming machine in June as part of our kind of launch of the TWiT Live video stream. We will build it. We will build it with your input. We will, in fact, give it away. I don't want to give Twitter a bunch of traffic. I mean, that's silly. So we'll figure out a better way to do it. So I apologize for anybody who unfollowed Kevin Rose. Please follow him. It's actually, there's still time.
No, there's not. It's over.
Midnight.
Besides that, you already pulled ahead by like 1,500. It's not easy. It's too late. You can't catch up.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kevin. Well, hey, you know what? He's going to be number one tomorrow, so it doesn't really matter. I just wanted to make it today.
No, he's not going to be number one tomorrow.
Right. Enough silliness. Let's introduce our guest, who's a very special guest, and I'm really thrilled to have him on. Brewster Kahle is an internet pioneer. He was with Thinking Machines in the early days of the internet, MIT graduate. He created Waze, W-A-I-S, which was an early a search tool, kind of pre-web search tool for the internet. He has since gone on to create the Internet Archive, its goal, and I think a very laudable goal, to archive the internet, terabytes of day being saved. You may have used the Wayback Machine, which is kind of a user interface to it, but he saves much more than you can even see on the Wayback Machine, so that future generations can know what stupid stuff we were up to, including Twitter, including Surprised Hedgehog and all the other stuff. Brewster recently was in the news, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. But Brewster, I'm thrilled to welcome you to This Week in Tech.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Did I get that all right? Did I make any mistakes in there?
Not one.
I remember we had you on the screensavers with your printmobile, which was a really cool idea. It was a print-on-demand bookmobile. So people would go in there, they would look at books. I guess it was from Gutenberg. Pick a public domain book, and you had a very fast printer in there, and you could print it and bind it and give it to them right there.
You know, we've been scanning hundreds of thousands of books, and yes, the idea of having a print-on-demand bookmobile, they're up and running now in Africa, Egypt, India.
They're still good. They're still
doing it so that people can get books when they want them.
What a great idea. What a great idea. Well, I'm going to talk about, there's two books related stories, two stories related to Brewster. One is books. Microsoft announced on Friday, I was kind of surprised. You know, Google had been announced this Google Print project to scan books in, and it was very controversial. In fact, John, you and I did a special episode talking about Google Print and the controversy and how silly it was that these publishers were trying to preserve these rights against the overall interest of people.
Right.
And I guess Google's still doing it, but Microsoft said, hey, if Google can do it, as usual, Mike, if Google can do it, we can do it, and had a similar project. And I know, Brewster, how are you involved with the Microsoft scanning project?
Well, we started a project called the Open Content Alliance, and Yahoo and Microsoft, as well as HP and Adobe, all participated to try to build a basically public access to the public domain. And these different companies participated in different ways. Yahoo helped kick it off and fund some of the early scanning. And Microsoft has put in money to scan over 300,000 books to try to have basically the public domain accessible by all, as opposed to, well, Google's project, which is, in fact, to lock down the public domain.
Really?
So that only it's available through their own search engine and their search engine only.
Oh, that's very interesting. So the Google
Open Content Alliance was to build basically an open collection of library books that are accessible to all. And actually, my hat is off to them. They put in millions and millions of dollars into the Internet Archive scanning system. And we're now scanning in 13 libraries. And when they bowed out on Friday, they released any restrictions on those books. So there's no restrictions at all. And also any claim they had to any of the equipment that had been put in all of these libraries, they also said, please keep going.
Oh, that's great.
Which actually I think is the right thing. Both what Yahoo started out thinking, and now Microsoft is back around to, is they're navigation companies.
The idea is
that they should basically be a navigation company as opposed to a book publisher.
Hey, Brewster, let me just stop you there for a second. A couple of things. One observation is that the Microsoft scanning, which took place, actually part of their big push was over here at the University of California in Berkeley. And I thought that what they came up with as a final result was better than the Google product by quite a bit. You could go into their site and you could download complete PDFs of the books. And you could, you know, search them in different kinds of ways, and they weren't, and you could separate them out from the public domain available to everyone, and the ones that are more restricted. The Google thing was more kind of a mess. You couldn't figure out what was going on, and you'd be in some book that was, you know, that you'd be reading, and then it just couldn't read. You can't read this page for some unknown reason. Now they did have this disclaimer on there that you can't use these books for anything. Which I thought was, you know, kind of weird.
Was that a sop to the publishers who hated the whole Google idea?
No. When they started out, it was they basically went with the complete open way for the first year. And then they thought that they were leaving too much on the table. For the second year that they did a bunch of scanning, they said that basically you can't put it in another commercial search engine, which we all thought was kind of a weird idea. So you couldn't basically go and have their books in another commercial search engine. How you could prevent that, I'm not quite sure. But that was what they said. And they released any of those restrictions completely. So the public domain is now completely the public domain. And when you clicked on one of those downloadable PDFs, the disks that were spinning were at archive.org. So all those books came from archive.org. Or at least all the public domain ones. They also did deals with publishers to go and have information available from them.
So those books are still going to be online, though, right?
Yeah, they're at archive.org. Just go there. 400,000.
Well, actually, I just right now went to live. I mean, the URL for people out there is books.live.com, and is that when I type in the book search there? Does that throw me over to your servers?
No, the books.live.com is searching their collection, including the publisher collection, and displaying books sort of in their on-screen Ajax-like interface. But the if you click on the download the PDF, it comes from archive.org. And their site, they said, is going to go dark. They're going to take that offline, which I think shows some of the reason why we don't really necessarily want the only library in the world to be on a commercial company.
Right.
Even a well-funded and, you know, established company such as Microsoft, is they can make a, you know, decision that it's not in there.
This actually brings me right back to software as a service and all the rest of these schemes where people get dependent on something and then somebody somewhere in an executive suite decides to pull the plug on it. The next thing you know, you go in there the next day and all the stuff is gone.
Yeah, no, the idea that the intellectual discourse of humankind should be on only one or two corporations' shoulders, I think, is Orwellian. So I think what Microsoft and Yahoo have done is absolutely the right thing, is try to kickstart the library system. And frankly, it's like having millions of dollars of VC funding for us to get all of the book scanning systems in place, debugged, rolling, and gushing at 1,000 books a day. But now it's up to the public sphere to take over the operations of this. So it does mean that we're going to have to scurry pretty fast and to go and try to fill in the funding that's now missing from Microsoft. But the Sloan Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, there's libraries in the Boston area where at the Library of Congress are all funding their own scanning and into this. But it doesn't make up, you know, the millions that Microsoft has been putting into it. So we are absolutely going to be going out and looking for funding. But all in all, so in the short term, it is it's really inconvenient. In the long term, I think it's the absolute right thing. Let's go and have libraries supported by the public infrastructure, and you can build any kind of search engine, all sorts of wacko, weirdo, interesting. Let's have a Google a month come out with all sorts of different kinds of features, all built on top of the public domain, and let's not lock up the public domain.
So when do you think when's the Microsoft site going dark, do you know?
No, I don't know.
Has Google picked up the slack here? In other words, where is Google in all of this? They're no longer it's keeping it a silo, though. They're opening it up. Can they help out in this?
They're scanning on their own, and they've put contractual restrictions, such as even the copies that go back to the libraries. The libraries can't even make those available in bulk to the public. So if you're doing research or education, you want to download a bunch of books to do some comparisons, the libraries are contractually restricted from keeping you from the public domain. Forever. So we see this as kind of a problem.
Yeah.
And so we've been really pushing on building an open system. Microsoft has helped. Yahoo has helped. We're looking for others to help. Luckily, the libraries are up for it. We've got 80 libraries that we're working with as part of the Open Content Alliance, and we're building this collection. So anyway, we're out to try to find more funding to fill in for where Microsoft has left off, but we're very thankful that they've basically put the millions into getting this system really deployed.
I was in Egypt in January, and they were very proud of the Library of Alexandria, which of course is the great library, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world that was burned down, and now they're creating a digital Library of Alexandria, which is a great idea. They're part of this project too, is that right, Brewster?
Absolutely. We got them through the Million Books Project, 5 scanners that are scanning Arabic literature. We get all of that. They get our books. If you go into the Library of Alexandria, which I really recommend, it's just gorgeous, and look to the right, on the first floor behind glass is where the Internet Archive is. We've put a copy of the Internet Archive there, and they've paid for all of that. And we're taking copies of their stuff. If there's one lesson from the original Library of Alexandria, which is probably most famous for, burning, is don't just have one copy. And so we're working there. We've got a partial replica in Amsterdam. And if there are a couple more replicas around the world, I think we really could make it a couple centuries before basically our library and those others all burn enough such that we lose the digital age.
Right.
Brewster, what does it cost to scan one book?
It costs 10 cents a page. And if you take your average book as being 300 pages, that's $30.
That's a lot.
And what that, well.
I'm surprised, actually.
It costs more than that if you're building a library.
Right.
If you take a library and the place to put a book is cost more than $30 to put one. And so we can go and scan that, OCR it, run it through optical character recognition so that it's searchable, put it in lots of different formats, make it available on the net on two continents, and it costs 10 cents a page. So at 10 cents a page, or you know, if you want a million book library, it'd be $30 million. That's the cost of a small city library for 1 year. And you could have not only that million books for that city, but for the world.
Infinite perfect copies, yeah.
And they're great copies. And
let's stop there. Infinite perfect copies, they're not. I've looked at these books.
Well, are you OCRing them as well, or are you just getting images of the page?
We're getting images of the page, and then we OCR them so that the words are there. And if you search on them, you pull up a page, and it bolds that section of the page. It highlights that part of the page. And there are people that are going and correcting the OCR as part of the reCAPTCHA project from the CMU guy, Louis Van Naan. And so anyway, it's really great to be seeing people. It's kind of – and we're also working with Gutenberg. And so the Gutenberg people are taking these books and correcting them to make them into – as good ASCII representations, and it's a commons. We're also, we've got openlibrary.org, which is an early, early beta site, but worth checking out, openlibrary.org, and it's one web page for every book ever published. It's a Wikipedia of books.
Wow.
We think this thing is going to be absolutely killer. We've loaded it up with 13 million library card catalog records, and I think at this point it's got maybe 200,000 full text of books. And the idea is to have it so people can cooperate to go and put these together. We're linking them to reviews. We're linking them to where you can buy them, where you can borrow them from, how you can download, whether they're available at from Google or where they're available full text so you can actually download them without them being crippled. All these sorts of things are coming up on the Open Library site. It's a big community site based around books.
Brewster, how are you dealing with the copyright considerations and the uproar that Google confronted when they launched their library project?
We work pretty well with, pretty much everybody concerned. We got the area of book scanning going mostly based on out of copyright materials. Mm-hmm. So there are not copyright issues. There are owners' rights issues. So, because these books are in people's collections and you have to get access to them and do they want to put restrictions on them, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And we've worked on that pretty well through the Open Content Alliance. So for out of copyright works, we're really on a roll. If we can find people to pay 10 cents a page, then these libraries will allow us to scan them and make them available on the net for free as long as there's attribution, which fair enough. They've spent billions of dollars building up these collections. Then there's the out-of-print works. Then those sort of break up into sort of orphan works and that sort of thing. And we came up with the term orphan works. And orphan works are now, there's legislation pending in the Senate and the House in the United States to free the orphans. Make it so that the orphans are, these are works that are under copyright.
Now this is,
you can't find anybody. They're commercially unviable.
This is very controversial legislation. Actually, I want to get into that subject because that's a fascinating subject.
So the orphan works, we're moving along on that. We're also on the out-of-print domain. We're looking to lend books over the internet, just in the same way that libraries have always lent books. On the in-print works, these are the commercial.
The publishers are happier if you lend than give. That's to the publishers' interest.
Oh yeah. I mean, libraries have always lent books.
Right.
And especially the out-of-print works. I mean, those are the commercially unviable ones, or at least currently unviable. The in-print works, we really hope that publishers themselves are going and making them available in some way. And they've been slow, but they're starting to do it. So what we'd really like is having hundreds of search engines being able to provide access to the materials that are out of copyright and out of print that are in libraries like Open Library, and you can get to them that way. And the imprint works are available from the publishers or from people like Amazon, booksellers. And if we go and put those three pieces together, out of copyright, out of print, and imprint together in a seamless system, then we've really got something. Until then, we're just going to have lawsuits and you know, snippets and all sorts of other sort of bad ideas that we'll all be thankful to pass on from.
Let's talk a little bit about the Orphan Works Act. Larry Lessig has gone on record saying it solves a very real problem, but it's a very bad law. It's moving. It seems to be fast-tracked. It looks like Congress, there are two different bills, one in the House and one in Senate. It looks like Congress wants to get this made law before it is adjourned. I know a lot of content creators, illustrators, and photographers in particular feel that it is an onerous requirement, this diligent search. Denise, have you been following this Orphan Works issue?
No, and it's been moving so rapidly, it really has sort of slipped right by me, unfortunately. I need to get more up to speed on it.
Larry's contention is that the issue, it's going to create a whole class of, a whole new business, essentially, of people who are there to do the, quote, diligent search. They're going to make money on it, but it doesn't really solve the problem.
I don't know what speed means. I mean, this thing was brought up years ago, and the Copyright Office, to their credit, held hearings on Orphan Works and got input from the studios, from all sorts of photographers, lots and lots of people. And there are about 700 formal replies to the Copyright Office calls, and they had hearings around the country. Those are fascinating reading, actually. It's a little dry, but there are museums, libraries, filmmakers going and saying what the issues are around Orphan Works. And where I think that I agree with Larry is, let's go back to founders' copyright. I think that Ben Franklin was actually a pretty smart guy. He might be actually smarter, who knows, than the current lobbyists that are helping put together these laws. So if we go back to founders' copyright, 14 years renewable once, then I think we'd be in a much better shape. Or even just give us the law before 1976, say Richard Nixon's copyright, and we'd be in much better shape in this digital era.
As opposed to Sonny Bono's copyright.
Yeah, well, the 76 right. Copyright Act was just a disaster. Anyway, I agree with Larry on that. But the Orphan Works legislation would allow at least libraries and archives to start making these works available. We think, anyway, it depends on what happens as it goes through the meat grinder of the House and the Senate, to basically make bulk access to out-of-print material available in the net and basically do a notice and takedown. If somebody wants to, you know, say, hey, I still have copyright to that, take it down off your library site, we'd be perfectly happy. So anyway, as best I can tell, that's what's going on here. So is it the best law? No. Is it better than 1976 and Sonny Bono and all those sort of lobbyist-fueled works? Yes. So anyway, we'd be thrilled to have whatever copyright reform that we can get in these sort of dark days of lobbyist controlled legislation.
Now, a lot of what you're doing is constrained by copyright law, and in fact, you're collecting materials that are right now copyrighted, and I presume that keeps you from putting them on the Wayback Machine and making them visible and so forth.
The Wayback Machine are our web pages.
Right.
We take a snapshot of every website and every page, every image, everything on every website every 2 months, and we have since 1996. And that if you go to archive.org and type in a URL, you'll see all of the past versions. And if you click on one of those, you see that, and then you click around, and you're surfing the web as it was.
You publish everything, though? I thought you didn't publish everything.
Oh, we publish everything.
Oh, I didn't know.
There's a six-month time delay on the donations of the web pages from Alexa Internet.
Right.
So that you won't see the most recent, but everything we've got we put up, except for those that things that people have said they don't want to be served. So if people put a robot exclusion up on their website, we retroactively obey that. Or if they send their email and say, you know, that was my old blog and it's referencing my ex-partner and, you know, I don't want that there, then we take it out of the Wayback Machine.
So you don't worry about copyright issues then with this material? I mean, this stuff's copyrighted material.
The things in the Wayback Machine?
Yeah, everything is.
Yeah. As I understand it, copyright's a little beyond me, but it's at least recent materials. So a lot of it probably is. So what we do is make it available like in a library, and we do notice and takedown on it. And that's how the web has always worked in terms of the search engine and the like. And so it's generally working. So what we'd like to do is that in more circumstances, but different media types have different modes around them. They have different traditions around them. So with the books, we've been going along the lines that we already outlined.
Yeah, you know, the thing is there, Leo, is that there's also some fair use issue here. And the other thing is that never really wants to be discussed, and we might as well discuss it, is the fact that Google has really archived the entire internet, today's internet, on more than a few servers in a certain redundant fashion.
Yeah, you can look at the cache of any page.
You can go to the Google cache right now. And bring up my web page from 10 minutes ago, and that's copyrighted.
Right.
Right, but the search engine litigation over the years have carved out exceptions for indexing and caching, and there's a whole body of law that applies to search engines in that regard.
So search engines are kind of exempt in that thing.
Yeah, I think the Internet Archive is performing a similar function and would be treated the same.
The complaint people have about the Orphan Works Act, photographers, for instance, say it's such a burden for me to see if somebody's using my stuff. The requirements for them for a, quote, reasonably diligent search are not particularly tough. And so I've got to find it. And then I can only collect what the use is worth, and they're afraid that standard for what it's worth will be set by the person who published it
This is the thing that really bugs me about this whole debate, which is that it's the photographers and the illustrators, both of them, and I know a lot of these people, I'm friends with them, but they think it's all about them. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, it's like, that's all anybody wants to do, is they want to steal your crappy photo from God knows when, and it's not going to show up, and you're not going to know, because nobody's looking at it. I mean, the fact of the matter is, this is not about some guy's one photo that he's worried somebody's going to steal. It's about these libraries of weird and interesting books and this intellectual property that is by the truckload, not by the negative, that is out there that something has to be done about. And that includes, you know, there's a lot of art, in fact, which is, I would say, yeah, the photographers can fall into that category perhaps. But stuff that can't even be put in art history books and things of that nature.
Well, look at documentarians. There's a great documentary called The Eyes on the Prize, which will never be aired again because of the rights issues with all the video. They got clearance for airings for a very limited period of time, and never again will it be seen. There's a very good example, and there are lots of them in the world of documentaries, of very good works that cannot be shown. And if you can, now, of course, in this case, it's things like the Martin Luther King estate, which assert the right to all the video, and it's charge a lot of money for access to it.
Stanford has an interesting project as part of its fair use project that's aimed just at documentary filmmakers that actually will, recognizing that problem that it's nearly impossible to clear all the rights for what you need to do, actually provides them with a form of insurance where if they have legal problems that crop up, there's a pool of attorneys that will represent them, and you know they have to follow various best practices to make sure that everything they're using is fair use, and if they follow it, then they get legal representation after the fact if they have problems.
My general inclination is just to break the law and wait for somebody to come after me. As you know, Denise, Larry was very clear. I heard Larry speak, and he said, "Don't break the law. Change the law."
Yeah.
It does seem to be how people are responding to these draconian copyright laws as well. Screw it. Instead, he's saying, "No, we got to fix it. We can't. You know, we are in a rule of law. We do rely on effective laws." So it sounds like, Brewster, you're in favor of this Orphan Works Act.
Oh, we'd like some help out here. I mean, we'd really like to get more of this to people. I mean, the truisms, I think, is everybody can agree with is people are turning to their computer now to answer questions. It is the library. And as if it's not on the internet, it's as if it doesn't exist. And what you can also find and get most people to agree with is the best we have to offer is not on the internet yet. So if we're raising a whole generation on materials that aren't the best we have to offer, we're going to end up with the generation we deserve. And this really is, on its face value, obviously stupid to do. And time is ticking forward. This is 2008. Come on, guys. We've got to get on with this. So we have a mechanism for delivering information. Terrific. We don't have very good business models out there. Oops. But we do have things that are working, such as libraries, to go and pick up some of the slack on some of this. We've got search engines. If we keep the search engines as opposed to republishers, that in general works. I think we've got moves. We can move beyond not just having out of copyright materials out there, but go for the orphan works and the out of print works within the library-like framework. And let's work to try to get publishers and authors paid for some of this stuff. Let's see if we can get some business models out there that aren't just advertising-driven systems from a few major media conglomerates. Let's go and have something that is worthy of having the intellectual discourse live inside the whole web infrastructure. So long way of saying, yes, we're in favor of the orphan works, as long as it's not too onerous to try to do bulk serving on the internet. If they go and decide that, oh, you've got to go and do way too much to go and put each and every thing up in a digital library, then we've got the same problem we have now.
Let's move on to another topic that also involves you, Brewster. You got a national security letter, something you couldn't tell anybody about, according to the Patriot Act. You decided to fight it. Tell us a little bit, now that you can, because you won and you can talk about it. Tell us what happened. When did you get this national security letter from the FBI?
Oh, we got this national security letter, which is this sort of extrajudiciary thing. It doesn't go through the courts, doesn't go through anything. Served on us in November of 2007. They demanded information about a patron of the Internet Archive. So they wanted to know address, identity, what this person had done, all sorts of information about a patron of the Internet Archive. And they served it on us. And in such a way that when our lawyers received it, they were instantly gagged.
They couldn't talk about it.
If they were to tell anybody, any of their colleagues, anything that was going on, they could go to jail. And they couldn't call me even to tell me what it was going on.
They couldn't tell you?
They had to physically come over to the Internet Archive, because the law enforcement folks made as a stipulation that you couldn't discuss it on the telephone. I guess they might have information saying that phones are bugged. But anyway, they had to come over to the Internet Archive, and once I was told about it, I was gagged. I couldn't talk to my wife, couldn't talk to the board, couldn't talk to anybody else there, had to act completely on my own to be able to figure out what the heck we were going to do about this. Do we sell out patrons' information for a request, a demand that's done without any court review at all, or do we push back on the United States government?
Denise, is this NSL, is this part of the Patriot Act?
It's part of the, and I'm not in front of my computer right now, but it's got an acronym, the Electronic Communications.
Something or something.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a Patriot Act that allowed them to do these kind of extrajudicial.
Well, I think it's a.
And they don't go through, they don't even go through FISA for this. This is just some.
Can you stop a second and do some definitions here? What do you mean by patron? Is this a user, a person who invested, some guy you know? I mean, what, or somebody who likes you? I don't get this.
Yeah, who is a patron? Yeah.
Patrons are the users of libraries. It's people that hold library cards.
So just basically some user?
This guy that comes
on the site once in a while?
This whole law was passed so that they could the feds could go to a librarian and say, who checked out what books? And the librarian would be enjoined about saying anything to anybody else. In fact, it's not just libraries. They could go to a grocery store and say, hey, did anybody buy hummus this week?
Yeah, but online, how are you supposed to track this stuff? People can't keep logs that long. They wouldn't have enough hard disk space. It's a ludicrous request.
Oh, I don't think so. Well,
all right. Well,
I can't.
My guy sure don't.
Ludicrous to us.
You actually had the information on hand that was being requested, I assume.
Well, the Internet Archive it has done something that I would suggest all libraries and actually all search engines should do. We don't keep most of our logs in the sense the IP addresses, which are personally identifiable in many, if not most, cases on the Internet, are the IP addresses which record in logs that are often kept for long periods of time are really the toxic waste of the digital age. And so we just never record those. So any user that comes to the Internet Archive site, we don't record their IP addresses. Only if you go and request a library card do we know anything, really. And people just type in an email address, which is an unconfirmed email address. And that's their Internet Archive identity, which they only need if they're trying to post something in the forums or add something to the collections of the Internet Archive. So we don't know anything about the users, pretty much.
So you couldn't respond.
Somebody that came to a web page. We don't know who came to what web page.
You couldn't respond to this NSL anyway.
Well, we didn't. Basically, the materials that we have, almost everything we've got, is available on the site. So there's nothing secret about what it is we've got. It's all sitting out there. There are all sorts of ways to ask a librarian a question, and the idea of serving them a super secret gag lettered is, I guess, one way to do it. But we're in the business of answering questions. We answer questions to hundreds of thousands of people every day. And some people actually call us up on the phone. We try to deal with that. But this idea of going and serving this letter to us, there wasn't very much they were going to find out about this person that they couldn't get off of the website. And so we decided with our lawyers from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the ACLU to push back. And the way you push back in this particular law is just pretty pathetic, is you have to countersue. So we countersued. We sued the United States government saying that this was an unconstitutional request for information.
Wow.
And the FBI very quickly wanted to settle.
Really?
They just said, look, we don't want this to go before a judge. And because of what we found on the East Coast, where another ACLU case found that this law was unconstitutional and it's under appeal, I can understand why. And the only way that we would settle this suit is if we could talk about it. If they released the gag, if they took the court case, the court documents out from underneath seal, we were okay with redacting things like who the user that they were looking for was, because we wouldn't tell them, so why would we want to tell anybody else?
Right.
So they took out just the specifics of exactly the piece that, you know, who they were looking for. But we have everything else there, what it is they were looking for, how the whole thing worked. Because what I wanted to do was be able to come on shows like yours and give a cookbook of how one responds to one of these things. And the first step is call the ACLU or the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Because even though once you talk to them, they're gagged, they were very, very happy to deal with this. EFF, they couldn't even talk to their colleagues. It was under a code name within their organization. They couldn't even say who the client was or what the general gist of what it is they're working on. But they're thrilled to do it. So that because there are organizations like EFF and the ACLU, and I hope all of your listeners go and contribute to these very able and very helpful lawyers, then we could respond. Because otherwise, can you imagine my going and hiring lawyers and starting to spend tens of thousands of dollars without being able to go to the board and go and say what it is we're spending money on? It's only because there are pro bono attorneys that are helping protect our rights that really make it possible for people to push back on these. Hoping that they're now, based on a congressional audit, they found that there are 200,000 of these letters put out during a 4-year period. It's 50,000 a year, or I guess 1,000 a month. There have only been 3 times that people have publicly pushed back on these. And I'm hoping by our coming out from underneath the gag, telling people about what's going on, that they'll go and follow in our footsteps and at least call the lawyers to find out what's going on and whether what their situation might be that's different from ours, and make an informed decision of whether they want to push back as well.
John, go ahead.
I was just going to say, now that it's over, Brewster, who was the guy they were looking for?
You can't say that.
I'll tell you later,
John. So, but let me say, isn't this an important tool in the FBI's ability to fight terrorism? Don't they need these NSL letters? Don't they need the secrecy?
Well, at least in our case, there are lots of legal ways to go and ask questions of libraries. There's subpoenas, there's court, there's warrants, there's all sorts of very fast track, all these sorts of things. And with the gag order, I don't know if they're really protecting themselves from scrutiny, or are they really protecting their investigations?
Yeah, I don't think telling your board is going to give the terrorists any foot up.
I by their going and keeling over on this thing right away,
yeah.
One, not even asking for the information anymore, much less wanting to preserve the gag, I think it's, at least in this case, is pretty clear what the answer to those questions are.
You know, I want to interrupt here for a second. I mean, Leo immediately throws the word out, terrorists, assuming that this had to do with terrorism. Which I think is the real problem here, is we don't know. When you start doing all the secret stuff, you don't know if people are trying to dig up financial data on somebody who's a political enemy, or if they're trying to look for insider information on stock market trading. There's a million good reasons to keep these investigations secret to this degree. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with terrorism, and that's like really the big problem here. You can use terrorism as a guise, as an excuse. I mean, if they're sending out tens of thousands of letters.
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands of letters. I mean, how many terrorists do we have in this country? Or are they all after the same guy? Or are they after something else? The problem is you don't know.
There's a good little video on the archive site. If you go to archive.org and search on national security letter, there's a little video, 25 minutes long, done by this group in Connecticut. And it's a good background. They've got some good government lawyers, some ex-Clinton administrators, going and saying that this stuff is just not needed at all, that this stuff is secret police stuff. So there's if there is other information out there, but it's so nice to be out from underneath this gag. The idea of basically being threatened by the United States government in this way and pushing back in such a way that there's potential criminal repercussions to all of this and not being able to talk to anybody about it. It's a huge relief to be out from underneath this. And I hope that future administrations don't just tweak these legislations. They just throw it out. This doesn't make any sense. There's no room for this in a democracy.
The overreaching of this just seems so stunning, because as best as I can understand it, the Electronic Communication Privacy Act was actually a check on the Patriot Act and put some limitations in place that it looks like, you know, in your case, Brewster, we're just blown by. You were supposed to be, in order to have this kind of letter issued, some sort of electronic communications provider. And, you know, of course, I think there's a huge question as to whether that's what the Internet Archive is.
Oh, no, this doesn't make any sense at all. Even in 2006, the Congress went and said, you're not allowed to serve these on libraries. And frankly, the Internet Archive had already met with the FBI and said, we are a library. You ever serve one of these things to us, we're going to fight it. And then months later, they go and serve one of these to us. So there are six senators from the Judiciary Committee that wrote a letter that's also posted on the archive.org site. So if you go to archive.org, and in the upper left, there's a post about this. And there's the actual letter that the senators sent to the FBI demanding information from them as to why they thought, even though Congress took away their right to go and demand these letters of libraries, why did they do it to a library anyway? I'd like to see what it is the FBI comes back with, and hopefully that's not super double secret as well.
Do you have on that same page, Brewster, kind of the cookbook that you're talking about for people, other people who get NSL? Letters and how to fight it.
Yes, and in general, there are links to the different news articles and the different things where we've put this out there. There's links to EFF and ACLU's pages that have all of the documents. So it's if you want to go and see what one of these things look like, that's up there. If you want to see the court documents and exactly what it is we put out there, and by the way, that's not copyrighted, so people can cut and paste to their heart's content. The idea is that this is meant to be a public airing of something that has only been aired three times since the 2001 or whenever it was, the Patriot Act really jacked this whole NSL layer letter thing up into a major scale manipulation tool.
Brewster, how big is the Internet Archive? How many people work for you?
The Internet Archive in San Francisco, we've got about 30, 35 people working here. And then in the scanning centers that are turning pages, there are about 150 to 200 people, 160, 170 people that are turning pages all around the country in Canada and the UK.
And how many terabytes of data are you storing every day?
We've got about 2 petabytes of disks on spinning, and it's over that because we compress the web data. Right. I don't know. It's probably 2.5 petabytes, and it goes mega, giga, tera, peta.
So let's go.
That's the kind of size that it takes to be a modern major scale library at this time.
It's called a lot of hard disks. So now, when you say people turning pages, I saw some online video showing some machines that were like turning pages or some robots. I mean, you actually have physical people that are sitting there with a scanner and they flip a page and throw it on top of a scanner and push a button.
Yes, we actually have physical people. So we've tried out the robots and we think that there will be a time that when the robots get to be cost effective enough and reliable enough that we'll want to use them. But what we went and found is actually people are very good and very caring about turning pages. So they turn pages, they raise and lower glass that flattens the page, takes pictures from 2 professional grade digital cameras, and they press a pedal, raise the glass, turn the page.
Wow.
And then take another couple pictures.
What software are you using?
We use Linux. We wrote all of this on top of the Linux operating system.
What about for the scanner?
Mostly open source. We designed and built our own book scanner and all the book scanning software. It uses mostly Internet 2 to bring the books, the images, back to the Internet Archive cluster. And it takes about 12 hours of processing to go and take a book from the image form till it's ready to go up on the Internet Archive site, with all the OCR and PDFs and the like.
What OCR system are you using?
We use a few different ones. There's one, the one that we're mostly using is from Luratech. It's a repackaging of another third party. And all those files are actually up on the archive as well. So if people want the OCR data that came out of the OCR engines, it's there. There's word-based OCR that's in XML that's up there with position information. It's sort of a Gutenberg-looking like version of the book. There's also the images, and they're all woven together into making PDFs, deja vu, and sort of an on-screen flip book, which we really like. That allows you to just click and with an Ajax-like viewer to be able to see the books.
That's neat. Well, Brewster, we really appreciate what you are doing with the Internet Archive. It's so important, and I'm just glad that somebody's taken this seriously and stepped up. If people want to donate or find out more, go to archive.org. There's a donate button there. You could send a check, or you could use Amazon Honor System or PayPal, or just give and support this important work. And now that Microsoft has pulled out, I'm sure you could use some extra donations.
Use the money to keep the books coming through. And thank you, John, Leo.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate the attention on all of these issues.
Well, we'll get you back soon. Thank you, Brewster. Brewster Kahle. And again, it's archive.org. We're going to continue on, though. There's more to talk about. In fact, Denise has a story on her blog right now, Logarithms, about our favorite subject, Twitter. But it's actually a much deeper subject than that. What's going on with the Twitter Waldman discussion, as you call it?
Yeah, there was a gal who's actually the community manager for Pounce.
Yeah,
Ariel Waldman, who has, I guess, had ongoing discussions with the folks at Twitter about someone, you know, posting things about her on Twitter.
She's being harassed, I guess.
Yeah, basically, you know, calling her names, not nice names at all. Names that they're actually quite scary and threatening. And, you know, she's friends with the folks at Twitter. I think she's had an open dialogue with them. And in the past, they've taken some things down. But she reached an impasse with them where something that she wanted removed, they decided, you know, was actually consistent with with their terms, and you know, Twitter is at this point trying to amend their terms of service to make it clearer that you know, they're not attempting to edit or moderate the material on the site.
Was the stuff being sent to Ariel direct messages, or were they public tweets? What was going on?
I think they were public tweets, but I'm not.
I was reading her. Actually, I got kind of involved only with her by talking about the fact that she's got to fix this post that she has about this episode, because it's confusing now because there's so many updates. The thing is kind of rolling out of control. Now I can't figure out what the heck's going on. But she, it seems to me that they were doing a lot of direct posting, you know, the @ thing.
Mm-hmm. And, but that's all,
that's public, though.
Yeah, and
I can imagine that Twitter's
directed, though. It's directed.
It's directed, but Twitter's point would be, well, we have a block button. Push the block button, and then you won't see anything more from that fella.
Yeah, but everyone else sees it, right?
Right.
Absolutely.
So her goal was not merely to get him out of her hair, but to keep others from seeing what he or she was saying.
Right, and if you follow along, I mean, Twitter's been blogging this. Biz Stone over there has a couple of entries on their blog. And on their community forum that talk about the fact that, look, you know, admittedly, when we put up the site, it was all kind of quick and dirty, and we basically modeled our terms of service on those of Flickr. And Flickr has some pretty, well, I don't know if I'd call them stringent, but, you know, some definite community guidelines of things that you can and cannot do and things that will result in your account being terminated, which, when Twitter ported those over, Twitter wound up with those same sorts of guidelines. And I think that Twitter has decided that actually, you know, they want to be more of a communication conduit than a community per se. And, you know, there are things that they will take down if they feel they cross the line. But in this particular instance, it didn't rise to that level.
So this is an important distinction between a publisher and a conduit. Can you talk about what that distinction is?
Well, there's this provision of the law that enables a whole lot of the activities on social networking sites that is 47 U.S. Code Section 230, fondly referred to as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and it immunizes site owners of all kinds from the activity that goes on the communications platforms that they are providing. You know, so whether you're a blog or your Facebook or what have you, if people are using your platform to communicate through comments or however they're posting their text or other material, they can engage in various illegal activities without subjecting you as the site owner to liability.
So if somebody's going on my blog in the comments saying, here's how you download movies illegally, I'm not liable for that.
That's right. And there was some suggestion made
and by the way, Leo, unless you're the one posting it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And if the only way you can sort of run afoul of the immunity that's provided under this statute is if you begin monkeying around with the material or participating in it in some way. If you endorse it, if you offer an editorial opinion that yes, you're 100% behind what this.
Well, how about this? How about if I start going through my comments and deleting some selectively, but not all illegal postings?
That's okay. The act actually wants to encourage. It is the Communications Decency Act, after all. It wants to encourage website owners to police their sites. So if your editorial decision is simply to remove something, that's not going to subject you to liability. It's actually fairly difficult to subject yourself to liability as a site owner under this provision, although we've seen some interesting case law come out in recent months, particularly from our own Ninth Circuit here in California in the roommates.com case, which found that the categories they were setting up, you know, they had a drop-down menu of various categories you could select from in creating your entry, that those actually violated the Fair Employment and Housing Act because they were encouraging people to make distinctions based on things like gender and age and sexual preference, various protected classes. So if the site owner is actually encouraging people to make those kinds of illegal distinctions, then the site owner will be involved in it too, says the Ninth Circuit. Now, that's a pretty anomalous decision and kind of out of line with the rest.
Yeah, but making a category is different than me going in and deleting a post.
Exactly. So if I think you're just deciding, you know what, this just strikes me as something I don't want on my site,
yeah,
you're perfectly able to do that.
What if I edit a post? What if I keep half of it but take out the other half? Does that in some way escalate the problem?
It can, yeah. It depends on the meaning that is left. You know, if you have somehow altered the meaning and injected yourself into the conversation, then you might have a problem.
Well, and I, you know, first of all, just on a purely human note, I really feel bad for Ariel, and I've seen people harassed in this way before, so I'm very sympathetic to that.
Mm-hmm.
And her initial complaint was that Twitter wasn't standing up to its own terms of service, which said that harassment would not be tolerated. On the other hand, I understand that Twitter afraid of crossing this line of Section 230? Is that what the issue is?
I don't think so. I don't think that's it. I think, you know, I don't know. You know, I haven't talked to them, and I don't know what legal counsel they have, but they're on solid ground under Section 230 if they want to remove things.
So they could do something
the
about
issue.
It.
Yeah, well, they could if they wanted to, and they have in the past.
Well, I understand then why Ariel would be upset. This,
yeah,
the larger issue is, and this isn't the first time that a blogger or a woman in the public, you know, Web 2.0 social network scene has been harassed. And it's a difficult thing to know how to respond to that.
I don't think it's that difficult. Just kill the guy off the site. I mean, what's the big deal? I don't get it. I think this thing's been dragging on too long. You got somebody who's a pest. I mean, we have these on our blog. Some guy's a pest. He comes on. He's got, he's contributing nothing to society. He's contributing nothing to the blog. Yeah, exactly. You just delete him and you kill his IP and that's the end of it. What difference does it make? The guy figures it's going to happen to him anyway.
The language that this guy used, I can't understand why Twitter would allow it, to be honest.
I'm not privy to their decision-making process at all. You know, it's pretty clear from Biz's comments that they don't want to be making judgment calls as to what's proper and what's not.
Their counsel, apparently.
It doesn't take a genius to see what's going on here. This is not like a judgment call. This is like, you know, hardcore porn, as it were. You know, it's easy to spot it when you see it. Unless there's somebody on the Twitter board of directors or somebody working at the company that's actually making these messages.
Dozier.
I don't get it.
It's John Dozier, who apparently is their counsel on this, and he's afraid they're going to cross the line.
Is John Dozier their counsel?
Oh, maybe not.
No, he was quoted in a piece on Wired.
Oh, he's not, okay, so he's not advising them, he's just somebody.
No.
But presumably they're getting advice like that.
I don't think so. The reason I called out that Dozier quote in my post was I found it so anomalous with my understanding.
It's wrong, is what you're saying.
Yeah, of Section 230 and how it operated. You know, I'm not very familiar with Mr. Dozier or his practice, but I think they represent a lot of people in defamation cases trying to go after any defendants they can. So I don't think he's a big fan of Section 230 and the way that it operates.
You know, a lot of people are on Twitter, including is it Kathy Sierra, the blogger who was attacked last year. And I could see this becoming an issue. You see it happen so much in so many places on message boards and on forums. People take this kind of anonymity that they have in these forums to sometimes act very poorly. And I don't see any reason why you don't stop it. Doesn't seem right.
Yeah, John's got a good point. I mean, every site owner has the ability to bounce whoever they'd like, basically, under the way that the internet operates, which is a good thing.
So you're on your iPhone right now.
I'm actually not. I'm on a landline.
Oh, shoot.
Nice try, Leo.
I tried because, of course, we're just about a week and a half, 2 weeks away from Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, at which they are perhaps going to announce a new iPhone. Interesting story in Fortune magazine. Apple takes delivery of 188 mysterious ocean containers. You could find out anything on the internet. There's apparently a search engine that gathers competitive intelligence by monitoring U.S. customs records of ocean containers entering American ports. It's called Import Genius. And according to Import Genius, there's been a major spike since mid-March in ocean containers marked with a mysterious new label, electric computers. headed for Cupertino.
Electric computers?
Electric computers.
As opposed to the non-electric ones.
Well, apparently this is the first time Apple's stuff that's come to Apple has ever been labeled as electric computers. But
it's probably a reflection of the quality inside.
Well, we'll see. But anyway, there's a lot of stock, maybe, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of something in those 188 containers.
Aren't we supposed to find out about that this week?
June 9th is when Steve will go on stage. Now, it could be, in fact, that they'll announce something first. You know, one of the rumors that's kind of interesting, and that's why I asked you, because I think of the three of us, you're the only one who has an iPhone, Denise. But the rumors are maybe not only a 3G iPhone, but something else. Something more like a tablet. Something a little bit larger. Would you salivate for such a thing?
The Newton 2?
The Newton 2 is here! Exactly the size of a Newton.
I was at the first G conference and listened to Steve Jobs swear up and down how Apple would never have a tablet.
Yeah. And he also swore they'd never put video on a screen.
Right.
I'm starting to think anytime Steve says we'll never do something, it's really a sign that he's thinking of it and planning it and going to do it. Well, we'll see. Anyway, I'm looking forward to it. I don't have an iPhone.
I love my iPhone.
Yeah.
I love it enough that, you know, when they get the 3G,
Are you going to trade it up?
I'm going to be happy to trash it and trade take up. The 3G, yeah.
Well, one thing you can do on your iPhone, and now we pause for a commercial break, is listen to your Audible books. How do you like that? Am I getting smooth?
Wow.
Audible.com/twit. If you'd like to take advantage of our special deal to get a free book, all you got to do is sign up at audible.com. Now, you have to be in the U.S., although I keep hearing from people in other countries who say, yeah, it works for me, and then some who say it doesn't work for me. So try it, even if you're not in the U.S. But you go to audible.com/twit. If you're not already a member, you can sign up. There are so many great books, 45,000. It's not just books, 45,000 titles, radio shows, lectures, speeches. There's a wonderful series from the Library of Congress that I listened to about a year or two ago that I highly recommend. I don't think I've ever recommended this before. They had a speech series. Some of the really interesting people, including David Weinberg, who wrote the Clutrain Manifesto. It's the Library of Congress series on the digital future, and it's really interesting. A couple of years old, but I have to say the people who spoke were so forward thinking that it is in fact very very useful. They also have some other stuff from the LOC, including historic presidential speeches. Yep. Yeah, Denise, I'm sorry.
I've listened to a few of those, and I agree. They're wonderful. And anytime you can hear David Weinberger speak,
seize
the opportunity because he's just amazing.
Yeah, it's a really good speech. He's talking about the blogs, I think, in this one. The presidential speeches from Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and John F. Kennedy. This is a good time in our election cycle to listen to some great speeches as the speechmakers start to tire and lose their steam. In this, Brewster Kahle, by the way, this is why I bring it up, is one of the speakers. He talks about his idea, how he created the idea to archive the web. This is from the Library of Congress series on the digital future. Also, Juan Pablo Paz, who's a Brazilian quantum physicist. Brian Cantwell Smith from the University of Toronto. David Levy, who is a fascinating fellow from Xerox PARC. Larry Lessig is in this one. It is a really good series. If you haven't heard it, this could be your free book. All you got to do is go to audible.com/twit. Sign up today. Get a credit for a free book. But I warn you, it's going to be hard to choose. There's so many great titles here. We're really thrilled. I just, at midnight this morning, I was at a pier in Sausalito as Roz Savage began her row across the Pacific. She is a amazing woman. She rowed across the Atlantic solo. I mean, she does this by herself. There's no chase boat. There's nothing. Solo. She's trying to become the first woman to row across the Pacific. And I gave her an iPod with Audible's permission, full of 323 Audible books. And she was so happy.
Wow. What's she rowing?
A rowboat.
Oh my God.
Roz. Well, the reason I mention it, besides the fact that I gave her these Audible books, is we're going to do a podcast with her. Rozsavage.com. Rozsavage.com. She's just amazing. Really inspirational person. And she left tonight. Last night I was there at midnight. She rode out under the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a special boat. It's like 16 feet. It's bigger than a regular rowboat. It's made of metal. But she's rowing it. I mean, there's no motor in it. There's no sails in it. She has five iPods. I gave her a fifth iPod. She's got solar panels to charge them up. She's got three cameras, a MacBook. She's got a satellite phone, which we underwrote. We gave her some money for the sat phone because she's going to call us three times a week and say how it's going.
Oh, wonderful.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Hey, if she's by herself, why does she need five iPods?
Because people keep giving her iPods. So the one I gave her is just books. She's got one with just music. She's got one with just podcasts. And I think she has the backups. John, she's going to be 3 months in the middle of the ocean. What if one falls over?
Oh, and it will. Well, it going to the toilet, for God's sake.
There's no toilet. What are you talking about, toilet? It's a rowboat.
Well, there is a toilet. It's called the Pacific.
Yeah, she's got a large toilet. If you want to watch, if you go to her website in the blog there, she has a marine tracker, and you can actually watch her GPS position. And there's a lot of swirling going on as she goes under the Golden Gate Bridge. I missed this. I left after she left the pier, but we're doing a documentary also on her, and my friend who's doing the documentary was shooting her from the Golden Gate, filming her from the Golden Gate Bridge. It took her eight times to try to get through the eddies. The tide was going out. That's why she left at midnight, to catch the ebb tide. But the eddies from the piers of the Golden Gate Bridge are such stiff currents, she couldn't get through them, And this is how dedicated, how an amazing person she is. She most people would have given up after six or seven tries. Eight tries, she finally gets through. She's well on her way. You can follow her on Twitter. She's Rod Savage on Twitter, and she is literally Twittering as she goes.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that funny? It's Rod Savage, R-O-Z-S-A-V-A-G-E. She's also texting. You can follow her via text. And I think that's what's happening, is she's SMSing using the cell phone, and that's going on to Twitter as well. But we're going to do a podcast with her. I'll be talking to her Tuesday live via sat phone, and we'll be able to follow her. I'm very inspired. She was, get this, a management consultant at Accenture. And she was about 30. And she said, screw this. I'm not having fun. She's British. And she said, I really liked rowing when I was at Oxford. I think I'll row across the Atlantic.
I mean, the Pacific.
Well, first she did the Atlantic. She's already done the Atlantic.
Oh, she's okay. I'm saying now she's doing
now
the Pacific,
she's going to be the first if she does this, and it's tough. She tried last year, and capsized. The boat capsized five or six times. I think seven or eight times, and finally the Coast Guard said, "Sorry, lady. Hey, lady, pull over." And they literally plucked her out of the boat. She's doing it again. I think it's just really cool. Anyway,
might not be a bad time of year to do it.
Well, you're very careful about you. She was waiting. The reason it kind of took me off guard, I thought she was leaving later, so we didn't launch the podcast yet. So I'm actually a little bit backlogged. I have interviews with her and video and all sorts of stuff we'll put up kind of backwards because I didn't think she was leaving yet. All of a sudden, she called me 2 days ago. She said, I'm leaving tomorrow. I said, what? So it's very cool. Anyway, she's got a lot of Audible books, and I'm when we talk to her, one of the things we're going to do is find out what she's listening to. That's by way, a long way around of mentioning Audible as again, and audible.com/twits.
Man, no kidding. Those guys are getting their money's worth.
And John, you will get a check any minute now. I apologize.
So never mind. I was always going to kind of pushing for getting a comp Audible account so I could test out.
Oh, I'm sorry. I keep forgetting that. Please, Dane, would you remind me?
Put it on the list with that microphone.
Come over here, and now we can give you lunch, and we'll give you the. You don't need the microphone. You sound fantastic.
By the way, Cyrus isn't open for lunch, which is a shame.
I know. Well, we'll go for dinner if you want, and you could bring your daughter and anything you want. It's yours, John. I owe you that big time.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
You're a kid. You're a kidder.
Don't worry. For the dinner, maybe.
Cyrus is great.
Yeah, well, it's definitely one of the top five places in the country,
oh,
apparently.
It's wonderful. Well, French Laundry is supposed to be the place.
Yeah, but, you know, it's...
I got an inn there. You want to go there?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Let's go there, too.
They do lunch.
We're going to be blowing through your part of the world soon, Leo.
Denise, come up here?
I'd love to be able to come in and see the new studio and stuff. I'm just going to have to see how our timing works. But we're going to Safari West. Have you heard of this?
Yes, that's right over the hill here.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so much fun. Your kid will love it. It's a safari. I mean, there's wild animals. We know the people who own it. It's really cool. And that's kind of in the hills between Sonoma and Napa County. So you've got to come here, have some wine, spend an hour with us. We'll do a special show. You could talk about all the things I'm doing that are illegal and wrong.
I'd love that. You think Milo and Huck could play with Tyler?
Yes. We'll bring Megan and Milo and Huck. You bet. Okay. That's a deal.
Cool.
So as we're recording this, either way, I do want to mention a tip of the hat to the folks at JPL and the University of Arizona, because as we are doing this, Phoenix, any minute now, will attempt the impossible, a soft landing on Mars. Now, by the time you hear this, you'll know whether it succeeded or not. Now, a lot of the people who are watching this on Twit Live are also watching NASA TV. And if I only had my TriCaster working yet, I mean, it's working, but I haven't hooked it up, I'd have a picture in picture so you could watch the NASA TV at the same time. But any minute now, we'll get word of whether Phoenix did it. This is a tough thing. It's got to go from 12,000 miles an hour in orbit around Mars. It hits that atmosphere. This is all autonomous because they can't control it. It's too far away. So it's got the computer programs running, hits the atmosphere, aero brakes, puts it, deploys the parachutes. It's got to get down to from 12,000 miles an hour to 5 miles an hour before it hits the ground or it's kablooey. The plan is for Phoenix to look for signs of life on Mars, modern or ancient, including traces of organic compounds, including water. It's a very exciting project, and I know a lot of people are excited about this. It's been a long time since NASA has attempted anything like this, since the 1999 crash landing. In fact, the last soft landing was Viking, I think. So it's been like 10, 15 years since they've done this. It's very exciting. Where do you come down on this, John? Are you in favor of space exploration, or are you one of those guys who says, save the money for humans?
I'm still wondering what you mean by that the TriCaster is working, but you haven't hooked it up yet.
Well, it's a complicated story, but the TriCaster, we're waiting for the update in the software that will allow us to stream out to StickM. This TriCaster, wait till you see. Well, you were a big Amiga toaster guy.
Yeah.
Is the successor to that. It is. Wait till you see what I can do with this, John. It's insane.
Well, we got one over at Cranky Geeks, you know, so it's not like I'm unfamiliar with
it. Oh, that's right.
Prop.
I forgot you use that for Cranky Geeks.
So, no, I'm a big fan of space travel. I mean, it's what's given us the high-tech age that we're in.
We wouldn't have Fisher space pens if it weren't for Apollo.
You know, those things don't work, by the way. Somebody gave me a Fisher space pen.
Okay, Velcro.
Well, that's maybe better.
Yeah. Hey, Denise, it's been great talking to you. I wish you all the best. I thank you so much for joining us, and especially for taking time out of your Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you. It was a perfect fit because I've been spending the weekend listening to Cory Doctorow's book, Little Brother.
Oh, which, let's give him a plug.
Yes, which fits in quite well with the whole national security letter scenario.
What is the story of? Because this just came out, and he is offering it as an unprotected download for audio. What is the story of Little Brother?
Little Brother. Well, I'm only partially through it, but it is a story aimed at young adults. But it's, you know, just a great science fiction story for anybody, and it is kind of scary. I mean, it's scary in the way that Harry Potter is scary too, but kids seem to be able to take it in and not be too traumatized by it. It takes place in the Bay Area, and there's a kid who's a very tech-savvy high school student. It takes place sort of in the very near future, and there's a terrorist attack on the Bay Bridge. And this kid and some of his friends get summarily rounded up.
Wow.
and questioned, and they decide, or this main character decides, that, you know, the national security system is completely out of hand, and that they're going to mess with it a little bit. And so he sets up a whole sort of underground network using Xbox Universals.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I've been saying for years that the future freedom fighters will all be hackers, because that's where the next invasion of our privacy. It's not the right to bear arms, it's the right to bear technology, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly what this book is all about. And about, you know, it's very topical for today, because the systems that are in place and sort of the villains of this book are the things that we deal with every day. You know, the fast track things in our cars that, if someone wanted to, could be used to track our every move. And very interesting stuff that he sort of.
Now, it's a juvenile, as you said. It's not an adult novel. It's his first juvenile.
So, well, yeah, I mean, that's who it's aimed at. But, you know, I'm 43 and I'm enjoying the heck out of it.
But you're a lawyer, don't forget.
Yeah.
Now, let's, Leo, you got the book on tape? Let's just play the end of it so we can get it over with.
I don't have the. Well, I do have the end, but I'm not playing the end.
Play the end. We really don't want to read this book. Just play the end.
Hey, Corey will kill me if I did. So, Corey did give us permission to play an excerpt, and I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put about, I'll put an excerpt of this at the end of the show. I could play a little now, but I could play a much longer excerpt at the end of the show.
That's okay. Play it later. Play it tomorrow.
And it is offered by Random House Audio. It's their first DRM-free MP3, which that was something Corey insisted on, $20 for the book. And you can get it from zipidede.com, ZIPIDEE.com, or at Corey's own site, craphound.com/littlebrother. That's probably the best place to go.
It's fun to have a book set in the Bay Area, too, and have it.
I'll tell you what I'm going to play. And you have you read Chapter 12 yet? This is where a huge illegal concert is going on in Dolores Park.
No, I haven't read that part.
Oh, well, don't listen. They get pepper gassed by the San Francisco police. It's great. I will play. He goes to Mission High School. In fact, I started playing it and you heard the Mission Burritos. I'll play a little bit more of it at the end of the show. We'll stick some in so you can hear of it. But, we love Corio, and I'm really, Corey's writing is fantastic, and I'm really excited that he's done a kid's book. This would be more like a junior high school book.
You know, I bought it for an 11-year-old good friend of mine before I'd gotten too far into it. Just because, you know, it's dealing with some pretty heady subjects of terrorism, et cetera. I think on balance, it would be great for anyone sort of over the age of 10. But there is a bit of death and fear in here, too. That
hey, we got to let our kids know they're going to live in an age where there's the Patriot Act. And you got to fight for your rights to a freedom.
Yeah, that's where I come down on it, too. I said, if they can handle Voldemort, I think they can handle this.
Heck yes.
Yeah, all I'm hearing is that Cory Doctorow is going to get a tax audit for the next 5 years.
Yeah, definitely.
For all we know, that's what the National Security Letter was all about. What is that Doctorow guy listening to? What's he reading on the Internet Archive? What do you bet?
I never thought of that one.
What do you bet? Hey, guys, I really want to thank you. It's been a fascinating, a more serious twit than usual, but I think these were very serious, important issues, and I'm really glad we could talk about them. John C. Dvorak gets less serious, more lighthearted.
Before you end the show, Leo, you got to bring up this Twitter thing that was part of the conversation that you dropped in favor of the, you know, hashing over this other stuff.
Well, I just want to say follow Kevin Rose. But also follow the real Dvorak.
I'm going to reveal something right now that I can do because this contest is over.
Well, it's over at midnight. Now, we're recording before it's over. Kevin could suddenly pull out at any moment.
You're way ahead of him by over 1,000, 1,500 people. The thing is, Kevin's decided, and I think Kevin would allow me to say this, and I promise not to say anything.
Well, this is not going to go out till midnight.
Well, that's fine.
It'll be over by the time people hear this.
He says he wanted to beat you badly.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Well, he hasn't.
Well.
What's he going to do? Is he going to pull out the stops? Is he going to do something?
Well, I don't know. He sure racked his numbers up out of the blue,
Well, how did he do that? He used Ignatian, didn't he? He used
illegal. You were leveraging your shows, and
until he did. He started
it. Yes, I know. So once you've actually started leveraging, then you pulled ahead of him again.
Leo, I have the solution.
This is like a bunch of little kids. You guys are a bunch of little kids. It's not like I care about getting to 20,000. Do the real Dvorak. Just go if you're on it. By the way, I need to get to that number. But it's beside the point.
If everyone follows D. Howell on Twitter, then this all becomes moot.
D. Howell, absolutely. And Roz Savage. And, you know, Twitter's been down so much this week. I try to use it. You know, I've been trying to use it for the radio show because it's kind of a nice way for people to ask questions. I got to go on the air yesterday at 11 a.m. When does Twitter go down? 11 a.m.
It's out of control crashing.
What's going to happen?
Well, they got 13 more million bucks or whatever it is, 15 or something like that. And
but it breaks all the time.
They have to re-engineer it. Something's wrong with the basic architecture.
But notice that all the other sites that do something similar, and we talked about this before, have the same problems. I mean, Pounce is no better. Jaiku's no better. I think it's in the nature of the business. And as you pointed out, what if Paris Hilton gets an account? It's all over.
Oh, it would be over in a minute.
What do you think, Denise? You use it a lot.
I do. I'm not, you know, I wouldn't say I'm addicted to it, but I am a regular user.
I think Ev and Biz have a problem. They're too it's too successful.
Yeah, but that was their problem with Blogger. I was an early Blogger user as well, and Blogger used to go down all the time. You know, they solved that problem. Twitter, I think, will meet some kind of similar solution.
Yeah, but Google will have to buy them.
Right. That would solve it.
Maybe.
It's happened before.
Maybe. Could happen. So please don't not follow anybody on my account. I was wrong. Valleywag picked up on my tweet that said I was drunk and out of control. I'm still drunk and I'm still out of control. And if you believe anything I say,
He was neither drunk nor out of control. It was an effort to submarine
and it worked.
Kevin.
So what were you going to reveal?
That was it. That Kevin, I saw him at a party like about 2 or 3 months ago, and he says to me, "I'm going to get Leo." In this one, he was like number 12.
Ooh.
He says, "I've had it." I said, "I'm going to go right past him. You watch, but don't tell him, because then he'll, you know, he may try to, you know."
See, he didn't know. I mean, I can, you know, if I want to, I haven't pulled out all the stops yet at all.
And so,
you know what I did? You know what I did that was effective? Yeah, he did creep up. He got within 50.
Yeah,
that scared the pants off of me. You know what I? You know what I did that was effective? God. This is it. Reverse psychology. I said, "Kevin, you win. The Twit Army bows to the Dignation." And all that did was infuriate the Twit Army, and of course, they immediately came back.
Well, good for them.
Yeah, we're not. We don't bow to anybody.
Whippersnapper.
Yeah, we don't bow to nobody. Of course, I think it might have had something to do with the breaking Twitter, but that's another matter entirely. So follow D. Howell. Follow The Real Dvorak. If you want to follow me, okay. Follow Rod Savage. Please follow Kevin Rose, because he needs the followers, poor
kid.
No,
he doesn't.
Oh, the poor guy.
But Leo, what are you? Aren't there a couple of Leos on Twitter?
There's only one, Leo Laporte. There's a phony Leo Laporte, but you could tell it's phony because he has a big handlebar mustache. That's not me. No, Leo Laporte. I'm just Leo. I'm the number one guy on Twitter. Who else?
It's true. It's. I think it's creepy.
You know what? It is bad because now I don't. Every time I tweet, I think 37,000 people are going to get this message, and it's completely blocked me. I can't do it anymore. It's scary.
You got to think that not everybody can possibly be listening at one time.
No, so. In fact, half of those are probably spammers. Probably none of it's real.
Right.
It's all imaginary.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I have to say this. I used it about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I had, couldn't find something on Google. I mean, I needed a reference, a specific reference. And I just asked my, you know, army. Yeah. I basically used them as Google, and within 5 seconds I had 5 exact answers. Bang, 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 bang.
It's incredible. That's where
amazing how well that works.
Yeah. It's crowdsourcing of the best kind.
Crowdsourcing. Exactly.
John C. Dvorak, thank you so much. Dvorak.org/blog. Don't forget, of course, there is Take 5. There is Cranky Geeks.
Tech 5. Although it was named that for that reason. Cranky Geeks, right?
No agenda. No mullet.
This, show.
This thing.
The Twit. Mullet's gone. The mullet's Twit. Gone.
The mullet's gone. Denise Howell is Logarithms at ZDNet. It's a great column. You must read it. Just go to blogs.zdnet.com/Howell. And, of course, Bag and Baggage is her personal blog, and she's on Twitter, D. Howell. And she's the greatest. Thank you, Denise. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. It was a pleasure, as always.
Another Twit. And well, thanks to Brewster Kahle. We really appreciate his time. Archive.org. Another Twit is in the can. Okay, so now that everybody's gone, let's listen to a little bit of Cory Doctorow's Little Brother. This is his newest book. It's aimed at younger people, but I think it's a great listen for anybody. It is available DRM-free for $20 from Cory's site, craphound.com/littlebrother. This is a little excerpt from Chapter 12.
That's when the sirens started. They were louder than anything I'd ever heard. A sound like a physical sensation, like something blowing you off your feet. A sound as loud as your ears could process, and then louder.
"Disperse immediately," a voice said, like God rattling in my skull. "This is an illegal gathering. Disperse immediately."
The band had stopped playing. The noise of the crowd across the street changed. It got scared, angry. I heard a click as the PA system of car speakers and car batteries in the tennis courts powered up. "Take it back!" It was a defiant yell, like a sound shouted into the surf or screamed off a cliff. "Take it back!" The crowd growled, a sound that made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. "Take it back!" they chanted. "Take it back! Take it back! Take it back!" The police moved in lines, carrying plastic shields, wearing Darth Vader helmets that covered their faces,
Each one had a black truncheon and infrared goggles. They looked like soldiers out of some futuristic war movie. They took a step forward in unison, and every one of them banged his truncheon on his shield, a cracking noise like the earth splitting. Another step, another crack. They were all around the park and closing in now.
"Disperse immediately," the voice of God said again.
There were helicopters overhead now. No floodlights, though. The infrared goggles, right, of course. They'd have infrared scopes in the sky, too. I pulled Ange back against the doorway of the church, tucking us back from the cops and the choppers.
"Take it back!"
the PA roared. It was Trudy Dew's rebel yell, and I heard her guitar thrash out some chords, then her drummer playing, then that big, deep bass.
"Take it back!"
the crowd answered, and they boiled out of the park at the police lines. I've never been in a war, but now I think I know what it must be like. What it must be like when scared kids charge across a field at an opposing force, knowing what's coming, running anyway, screaming, hollering.
"Disperse immediately," the voice of God said.
It was coming from trucks parked all around the park, trucks that had swung into place in the last few seconds. That's when the mist fell. It came out of the choppers, and we just caught the edge of it. It made the top of my head feel like it was going to come off. It made my sinuses feel like they were being punctured with ice picks. It made my eyes swell and water, and my throat close. Pepper spray. Not 100,000 Scovilles. 1.5 million. They'd gassed the crowd. I didn't see what happened next, but I heard it, over the sound of both me and Ange choking and holding each other. First the choking, retching sounds. The guitar and drums and bass crashed to a halt. Then coughing. Then screaming. The screaming went on for a long time. When I could see again, the cops had their scopes up on their foreheads, and the choppers were flooding Dolores Park with so much light it looked like daylight. Everyone was looking at the park, which was good news, because when the lights went up like that, we were totally visible.
"What do we do?"
Ange said. Her voice was tight, scared. I didn't trust myself to speak for a moment. I swallowed a few times. "We walk away," I said. "That's all we can do, walk away, like we were just passing by. Down to Dolores and turn left and up towards 16th Street, like we were just passing by, like this is none of our business."
"That'll never work," she said.
"It's all I've got."
"You don't think we should try to run for it?"
"No," I said. "If we run, they'll chase us. Maybe if we walk, they'll figure we haven't done anything and let us alone. They have a lot of arrests to make. They'll be busy for a long time." The park was rolling with bodies, people and adults clawing at their faces and gasping. The cops dragged them by the armpits, then lashed their wrists with plastic cuffs and tossed them into the trucks like rag dolls. "Okay," I said.
"Okay,"
she said. And that's just what we did.
I should have paid attention. I don't know what I'm going to do. Too much work. The problem is, there's no limit. My server's completely collapsed. So here's the deal. I'm just trying to get the thing up, but I have a hell of a time. What blue screens? Like, forget it. I'm killing you.